Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. Episode 279, Dean Williams and Bishop Merriman compete for Anglican souls as de Villiers Graaf ponders. We're up to the early 1880s, where world events are intersecting in various ways with Southern African events. The mere ratification of the Pretoria Convention in 1881 failed to bring peace and prosperity to South Africa. The frenzied speculation in diamond shares reached its height in 1881, and war expenditure had swelled the tide of fictitious prosperity which had flowed from Table Bay to Ladenburg. Now the troops in glory departed. Natal, after the pomp and ceremony of the Wolseley period, drifted into a political backwater, and yet clamoured for responsible government and an augmented imperial garrison. In the Cape, the overcapitalised diamond companies began to topple, and banks shortened credit. In 1882, the crash came. John Scanlon, the Cape Prime Minister, succumbed to what some called retrenchment mania and laid off judges amongst other members of the bureaucracy. Times were bad and getting worse, with phylloxera visiting the Western Cape vineyards. Drought had smote the land and red water fever the cattle. It was Old Testament level pestilence and suffering, at least if you read the journals of the time. Did I mention the outbreak of smallpox as well? How remiss. It scoured Cape Town first, this pestilence, from whence it followed the railway and wagon route to the diamond fields of Kimberley, and from there into the Orange Free State and Basutoland. Then plagues of locusts chewed through what was left. For anyone who would return to an earlier epoch in South African history, believing that these were golden years, perhaps the reality I've just outlined would make you recalibrate your time machine. S.J. du Toit launched his pro-Afrikaans campaign by the early 1880s, railing against die Engelse and the elites in the Cape, who were determined to keep speaking High Dutch instead of this new form of language, which was disparagingly called Kitchen Dutch. Emerging at this messy moment to influence South Africa forever was a lawyer who eventually became known as Lord de Villiers. His African story begins on May 6, 1689, at the end of a four-month voyage, when a party of refugee Huguenots on board the Zion made their way onto Table Bay shore. Among the emigrants, there were three brothers, Abraham, Pierre, and Jacob de Villiers, son of Pierre de Villiers of La Rochelle in France. They brought with them a letter for the governor, Simon van der Stel, extolling their virtues as top-rate winemakers, expert at laying out and managing vineyards. The letter was signed by the members of the Chamber of Delft in the Netherlands and ended, "You are recommended to give them a helping hand," which was an order. All refugees, you see, need helping hands. The brothers had witnessed the brutality of ethnic and religious violence in Europe, where Catholics and Protestants were at each other's throats. A helping hand was duly given by van der Stel, who granted the brothers farms strung out along the Berg River Valley, the frontier back in those days. The brothers brought their newlywed wives with them, and of the three we'll focus on Pierre de Villiers. He died in 1720, leaving his widow and young son Pierre, who was 15. Young Pierre then aged a bit and married Hester Roux, an older woman, a widow, in 1725. She bore him a son. Since French was dying out already, they named the son Pieter. Pieter wasn't idle in the procreation business. He was married twice. His first wife bore him 9 children. His wife died, then his second wife, Johanna, bore him another 8. The 16th of 17 children was Jacob, who married Suzanne Berhardt, whose family originated from the Bavarian Palatinate. Their eldest son, Karl, grew up in the Paarl, and he in turn married Dorothy Retief, and in their 20 years of married life, she bore 9 children. The fourth child and second son was John Henry de Villiers. The house in which he was born still stands on the main road facing Paarl Rock. They lived simply, which is how everyone lived in the 1840s. John Henry, or John Hendrik, as most called him, learned to fear God and to honour the Queen of England. For a man who was part French, part Dutch, part German, and who knows what else, he identified as British, not English, I hasten to add. Later in his life, he wrote a letter to Sir Alfred Milner, who we'll meet in a few episodes, saying, "Our family has for several generations been British." Born into a simple agricultural South African family of 1842, He entered the Cape Parliament in 1867, and it's no exaggeration to say de Villiers' life was to become inextricably entwined in the history of South Africa. He lived through some of the most complicated and controversial periods in the country's past. He was obsessed with two things, the law and federation of South Africa. By 1875, he was the foremost judge in the country, with a somewhat contradictory and yet balanced affection for both Britain and South Africa. He belonged to no particular political party, trained in the secrets of dispassion, a legal phrase. His capacity was to see many sides of the story, which infuriated the extremists. The British losses in the Transvaal had shaken those in the Cape who would support imperial policy, particularly of the English-speaking Kopanaars. The colonists were struggling with their identity, and it's in this period that a form of national consciousness began to develop. It's difficult to understand this these days. In the 1880s, South Africa was still a mishmash of rebels, settlers, African chiefdoms, Khoisan raiders, dirt tracker miners, trek boers, wild Baltic and Nordic merchants, American, Australian frontiersmen. Every geographical locale was represented by a different language, so folks like de Villiers, who obsessed over federal ideas, were outliers. Self-government meant they leaned towards the Union Jack, the English for defence, but not the Union Jack as a cloak for interference in the internal affairs of the Cape. Somewhat confused, although lawyers like de Villiers could explain that apparent juxtaposition, it was a ruling he made concerning cosmology, religion, and through the lofty spires of the church, that this point of view emerged, particularly the Anglican Church of South Africa. Not for the first time would the church point the way politically to the state. Squabbling bishops and priests abounded. The quarrels divided the Anglican community, particularly in Natal, into adherents of the Church of England and adherents of the Church of the Province of South Africa. The two main questions for these two parts of the church were these. Must Anglican bishops in South Africa be appointed by letters consecrated by the Archbishop of Canterbury? And secondly, was the church in South Africa bound by acts of an imperial parliament in England, far, far away? De Villiers was going to decide both questions. And in doing so, he would set the scene for a future South African republic, while also setting in stone some of our concepts on the right to practice what religion we prefer. Dean Patrick Williams of Grahamstown was a cantankerous man, hooded brows, scowly face, dark, perturbed exterior, dressed all in black, a dean of the Anglican Church who was, if nothing else, a character. His superior, in our true tale, was Bishop Merriman, who brooked no opposition. Scene 1, Act 1, wide shot of Grahamstown, where two men of the cloth are facing off against each other, a cantankerous dean and a pusillanimous bishop. While not exactly the OK Corral, it was something of a Mexican standoff. If I can still say that without getting a sternly worded email from the Diocesan Diversity and Inclusivity Oversight Committee. Parishioners whispered that Dean Williams was not inclined to join with the clergy of the Grahamstown Diocese in prayers for rain until inspection of the barometer convinced him rain was indeed coming. When the barometer dropped, Dean Williams would hurry along to the church and pray for rain on his own account. When the windows of heaven duly opened, he preached at his reverend father in God and his clerical brethren on the text that went, "The fervent, effectual prayer of the righteous man availeth much," implying that his rain-making prayer prowess meant he was a little closer to God than Bishop Merriman. The trouble really started, however, when Dean Williams denied Bishop Nathaniel Merriman the right to officiate in Grahamstown's St. George's Cathedral without his permission. Bishop Nathaniel Merriman and his mentor, the formidable Bishop Robert Gray of Cape Town, belonged to the Oxford movement, the Tractarians, as they were known. They wanted a high church that was spiritually independent of the British government. They believed the church should be governed by its own bishops, its own synods, free to set its own doctrine without a secular British Parliament telling them what to do. And so they formed the Church of the Province of South Africa, CPSA. That was Merriman. Dean Williams, however, was old school. He had been appointed by the Imperial Government as Colonial Chaplain of the Church of England, and he had taken the oath of obedience to the then bishop appointed in the old style by what were known as letters patent. Dean Williams was a staunch low church evangelical, an Erastian, someone who believes the state should have authority over the church. They wanted the church in South Africa to remain strictly bound to the mother church in England, governed by English law and the British crown. They feared that if the local bishops got total control, they would enforce popish Anglo-Catholic rituals and lock out the evangelical Bible-focused traditionalists. To them, letters patent, which was a royal decree from Queen Victoria, were a sacred shield. If a bishop wasn't appointed by the Queen, he was a rebel. In the early 1870s, St. George Cathedral was transferred to the Bishop of Grahamstown for the perpetual use of the Church of England. Soon afterwards, Dean Williams was dispatched to Grahamstown by the Bishop of Cape Town. He presided over a church synod which elected Merriman as the bishop, his own boss. So, you can see, trouble began immediately. Dean Williams stopped attending the provincial synod held by members of the Church of England in St. George's Cathedral in Grahamstown. Bishop Merriman, said Dean Williams, could not officiate without the dean's say-so. In 1879, crisis! The bishop gave notice he intended to preach, but lo, did the dean seize the pulpit first from under the very nose of the Bishop Merriman and began a sermon all of his own. Picture the scene in Grahamstown, Sunday morning, packed cathedral, the air is thick with tension. Bishop Merriman, an old school frontier walker known for his stoic discipline, processes in, ready to deliver his sermon, but Dean Williams, younger, faster, and utterly ruthless. Before Merriman could ascend the steps, Williams darted past him, took the pulpit, grabbed the rim, and launched straight into his own sermon. The bishop protested, but not too much, just a bit, then left the cathedral followed by half the flock, the congregation. The visual of Merriman standing there completely upstage under his very nose, followed by the dramatic exit of half the congregation into Grahamstown's streets, is pure gold. It split the town in two. You are either a dean's man or a bishop's man. Then Bishop Merriman summoned Dean Williams to appear before the diocesan court. He didn't pitch, so he was suspended in absentia. In what you could call the extra knife twist in the ribs of religion, he was summarily excommunicated from the church. Dean Williams ignored that and continued to officiate. The bishop finally appealed to the courts to enforce the sentences of the ecclesiastical tribunal. A judge would have to rule on their rights. When Dean Williams stopped attending the provincial synod, it wasn't just a scheduling conflict, it was a formal declaration of non-recognition. Furthermore, Williams claimed cathedral autonomy. In church law, a dean is the master of his cathedral. Williams weaponized this, telling Bishop Merriman that just because he was a bishop didn't mean he could just stroll into St. George's and start preaching without the dean's written invitation. Bear with me, this gets more interesting. The story shifts from a local ecclesiastical brawl to a landmark legal precedent that reshaped the British Empire and South Africa. When the case landed in front of Sir John de Villiers, the brilliant Chief Justice of the Cape Colony, he looked at it through the cold lens of secular law. When Chief Justice John de Villiers handed down his ruling in Merriman v. Williams, 1882, he approached the matter entirely through the lens of secular law rather than ecclesiastical authority. His central finding was that the letters patent issued by the Crown to colonial bishops had become legally ineffective once the Cape Colony gained its own parliament and responsible government. The Crown simply no longer had the power to impose ecclesiastical jurisdiction on a self-governing colony. This meant that Bishop Merriman's authority, derived from the structures of the newly independent Church of the Province of South Africa, could not be legally enforced over a cathedral held in trust for the Church of England, as established by English law. It predated the change. De Villiers ruled in favour of Dean Williams, confirming that the properties and endowments of St. George's Cathedral in Grahamstown remain bound to the original trust, the Church of England, as by law established, and could not automatically transfer to or be claimed by the CPSA, which was an entirely separate and independent religious association. The judgment was a landmark not merely for South African ecclesiastical history, but for the broader question of how English church law applied or ceased to apply across the self-governing empire. At first glance, it appeared that Dean Williams had triumphed, as indeed he had. The ruling confirmed that properties held in trust for the Church of England, as established by law, could not pass to an independent body like the Church of the Province of South Africa. This left the CPSA without the cathedral and its endowments, forcing them to build independent legal and institutional structures from the ground up. Meanwhile, the Church of England faction retained the building but remained largely cut off from the broader provincial church that was growing around them. There was complete pandemonium on the ground. Across the Eastern Cape, congregations were bitterly divided. If a local parish priest supported the bishop and the CPSA, but the wealthy church wardens or trustees were deansmen who wanted to stay with the Church of England, a standoff normally ensued over who physically owned the building. In several towns, trustees literally went down to the local parish churches on Saturday night, changed the padlocks, then barricaded the doors to prevent the bishop or his appointed priests from entering to conduct Sunday services. So the 1880s saw the formalization of two parallel Anglican realities in South Africa. You had the CPSA, the bishops loyalists, and the Church of England in South Africa loyalists. Parishes that stayed loyal to the English crown found themselves utterly ostracized by the wider regional church hierarchy. While Dean Williams appeared to be riding high after his legal victories, his triumph was short-lived and deeply bitter. He had successfully retained control of St. George's Cathedral and its local endowments, but he was now spiritually marooned. He was an excommunicated dean in a colony where nearly every other Anglican pulpit was now aligned with the CPSA. The constant grinding stress of the decade-long legal battle, social isolation, financial manoeuvring took a massive physical toll on him. Dean Williams died in August 1885 at the relatively young age of 56. His death left the Loyalist faction leaderless, throwing St. George's Cathedral into a brand new crisis. Who replaces an independent dean when the local bishop refuses to recognize the pulpit? It also had another effect. Because the Loyalist Church of England parishes had won the right to keep their local colonial endowments, they mistakenly thought they were secure. But they had lost the massive systematic financial backing of the Mother Church's missionary societies in England, like the SPG, the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel. Those societies preferred to channel their funds through the official bishops of the CPSA, the South African Anglicans. The Loyalist faction slowly disappeared, starved of cash, unable to fund new parishes or build schools. The bishops realized that English gold was a trap. If they wanted spiritual independence, they had to build their own financial engine. Throughout the 1880s, the CPSA aggressively began establishing their own local trust, provincial funds, and a tithing system. They legally structured every new church built after 1882 so that the title deed was held directly by the provincial synod, ensuring that no rogue dean could ever steal the pulpit or building from under a bishop's nose ever again. Dean Williams and his allies fought to keep South Africa bound to the British crown and English law, yet by forcing the courts to define the church's legal status, they inadvertently accelerated the birth of a fiercely independent, self-funding, and uniquely South African Anglican structure that would outlive the British Empire itself. While Anglicans fought over each other's souls, across the world, things were going on. Like in the American state of New Jersey, the town of Roselle switched on the United States' first electrical streetlights, January 1883. Meanwhile, in Japan, the Tokyo Electrical Lightning Grid was launched, one of the largest power grids in Asia at the time and throughout the world. Milan in Italy inaugurated the first Central European power station. Boston, meanwhile, launched the world's first vaudeville theater. And in Italy, Carlo Collodi published The Adventures of Pinocchio. In April 1883, the first Sevens rugby tournament was played at Melrose Football Club in Scotland. Then in May 1883, Krakatoa exploded, killing 37,000 people in the tsunami it generated and swallowing up over 160 towns and villages. Robert Louis Stevenson published Treasure Island in May 1883. In June, the catastrophe at Victoria Hall in Sunderland in the UK, where a rush for treats and sweets resulted in 183 children being asphyxiated. It's also the year the first ever rodeo held in Pecos, Texas, and the last quagga died in 1883 in an Amsterdam zoo. In Australia, Sydney Boys High School was founded in October 1883, and in the US, the Supreme Court rolled back part of the Civil Rights Act of 1875, allowing corporations and individuals to discriminate based on race. A war was going on between the French and Vietnamese forces in French Indochina, Vietnam, and the British Parliament was musing over a law that would allow Indian judges to try Europeans in India. The British community in India rose up in protest and defeated the measure. On July 22, 1883, King Cetshwayo Kampande barely escaped with his life when his newly rebuilt capital of Undini at Ulundi was attacked by rival chief Zibebu and his Mantlakazi forces. Wounded in the assault, Cetshwayo fled into the Nkandla forest. More about that next episode. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform and my little newsletter. You can sign up for that at desmondlatham.blog. Until next, au revoir.